Hello, Live Living Family. I'm Catherine Kinley, and we are privileged to visit once again with Dr. Andrew Newberg. Hello again, Dr. Newberg.
Hi, how are you?
I am great. So glad that you could join us once again.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you again.
Dr. Newberg is the Director of Research at the Myrna Brin Center for Integrative Medicine at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital and Medical College, and is also the Adjunct Assistant Professor in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. He's considered a pioneer in the neuroscientific study of religious and spiritual experiences, a field frequently referred to as neurotheology. So this is a rather unique area of great interest to us. In fact, our previous discussion has been the most active feature in our last Live Living issue. So the subject of the effects of prayer on the brain and the physical body is obviously of great interest to so many of us. In that conversation, which, by the way, is still available on our Live Living website for those of you who haven't yet had the opportunity to listen in, Dr. Newberg and I discussed that he found that unlike a speech center, a vision center that's clearly identifiable in the brain, the spiritual center of the brain, or the soul, so to speak, is that is more active during spiritual activities such as prayer, reading scripture, worship, etc., is really the entire brain. And in fact, many times the entire body, since these activities affect other organs, such as the heart and maybe the digestive organs and so forth, depending on the person or even that specific event. We also learned that an intentional and intense program has many beneficial short-term as well as long-term effects for a person, physical as well as psychologically stabilizing benefits, which is very exciting to learn. Today, we would like to discuss more specifically what's going on in the brain during two distinct types of communication with God, one being centering prayer, and two, the speaking in tongues, also known as glossolalia. So Dr. Newberg, we do have an article on centering prayer by Father Thomas in the current issue of Live Living.
Oh, great.
But could you please give us a brief explanation of the unique characteristics of centering prayer as opposed to the more common types of prayer, such as reciting a scripted prayer like the Lord's Prayer, or perhaps a brief petition like, Dear Lord, help me now?
Well, I can certainly tell you the description as it was provided to me by the Franciscan nuns who participated in our research study. And basically, their description to me about the centering prayer was that it is a contemplative type of process or even a meditative type of process where it's not so much that you are repeating a particular phrase or prayer over and over again, but you are continuously looking at it, contemplating it, thinking about it, feeling about it, and you keep bringing your attention to that particular prayer or a particular phrase from the Bible as an example. So, and they will do this for anywhere from 10-15 minutes up to an hour or more, depending on what they're trying to achieve or what they're trying to do. And the specific prayer or phrase can be different from time to time. It sort of depends on what is relevant to them in the moment, what's important to them, and then they bring their attention to this. They focus their attention on the particular prayer or phrase. As they do this, part of the experiential elements that were described to me is that they do begin to feel a bit of a, I guess as they describe, kind of a binding with God, a connection to God, a loss of the boundary between themselves and God as this process continues. So it's a very powerful experience for them. There are frequently some very strong emotions, feelings of love, joy, and so forth, as well as this deep sense of interconnectedness with God. And so that was basically how it was described to me. And we designed a study where we could look at what was going on in their brain while they were doing the practice.
And when you did scan these nuns' brains, they showed tremendous activity in the frontal lobe and the right hemisphere of their brains during centering prayer. Can you tell
That's
us
correct.
Why these regions of the brain are so important, especially in regards to our spirituality?
Well, the frontal lobes are very involved in a lot of crucial human functions. The frontal lobes are primarily involved with our ability to focus attention. So whenever we concentrate on anything, we use our frontal lobes. If we're trying to drive a car or solve a problem, we use our frontal lobes, and we have found that the frontal lobes are activated in a variety of different contemplative and meditative types of practices, and that's included meditation practices, prayer practices. When you are specifically, purposefully, and willfully concentrating on something, then you activate that frontal lobe. Now, part of why this may also be relevant in kind of a more global health and psychological well-being context is that the frontal lobes are also involved in helping to modulate our emotions, to regulate our feelings of rage and so forth. In fact, some people have argued that the frontal lobes are very important in our feelings of compassion, in our feelings of social interaction, our ability to connect with another person and understand and have empathy for another person. So as we activate the frontal lobes, not only are we activating them because we are concentrating, but we may also help to enhance our own personal emotional control and our feelings of compassion and empathy for other individuals. That's in large part why this is probably a very important element of this kind of a practice, because it not only activates the brain, but may actually alter the way the brain helps us to perceive and to interact with other people down the road.
So fascinating. Our Lord would say, worry about nothing, pray about everything, and it sounds like he kind of knew what he was talking about.
Very consistent with the brain functions that we've seen, yes.
Absolutely. So then, that was during centering prayer, a long-term, a period of time of deep meditation, contemplative type of activity.
Right.
Now, how is that opposed to glossolalia? How is glossolalia or the speaking in tongues different?
Well, actually, before I answer that question, let me just say one last thing about the centering prayer. The other area of the brain that we have found to be particularly relevant is an area of the brain called the parietal lobe, which is located in the back part of the brain, which normally helps us to establish our sense of self. And it's interesting that in the practice of centering prayer and several other meditation practices, we see a decrease of activity in that area, and we think that that's associated with that experience of losing one's sense of self, feeling that deep interconnectedness with God, with the universe, whatever it is that the person is experiencing. But specifically in the context of centering prayer, that sense of deep connection with God, we think, is probably associated with this experience, this change of activity going on in an area that normally helps us to establish that relationship, at least on a psychological level. So that, in and of itself, was also one other very interesting finding in the centering prayer study.
Now, as far as
glossolalia goes, we actually find a very different kind of pattern. In fact, one of the main findings that we looked at or we saw was that we saw a decrease of activity in the frontal lobes, and we think that this decrease of activity is also consistent with what the person experiences when they engage speaking in tongues. In that context, they are not, at least this is how it's been described to me, they are not purposely trying to make this happen. They are not purposely making these vocalizations. This is something that's kind of coming through them, if you will, coming through them through God. It's not their own consciousness that's doing it. And again, if the frontal lobe normally helps us to consciously do things, it would make sense that when we have the experience of not using our consciousness, that area would be decreased rather than increased. So we see that as part of this experience of surrendering oneself, of allowing oneself to experience something deeply spiritual. So it's a very powerful experience, and it ultimately seems to be very consistent with the kind of changes that we see going on in the brain, especially with regard to that frontal lobe.
That's fascinating. So as the frontal lobe is activity is diminished, our sense of will to make these activities or make these thoughts or sounds, this language is not coming from our, correct?
That's correct. Again, at least based on what we can see through the brain, and again, we did a very similar kind of study where we inject people while they were in the practice of speaking in tongues. That state seems to have a very different kind of brain signature, if you will, compared to prayer. It doesn't make it better or worse, at least on the basis of the brain functions, but it does show that there's a distinction, and the distinction, I think, is very consistent with what the person is actually experiencing.
So, Dr. Newberg, as I understand it, as you described the activity during glossolalia, that according to those who do speak in tongues, it's not an intentional act on their part, but rather allowing their vocalization mechanisms to be used or controlled by someone or something else. Is that correct?
Right. That's the way it has been described to me, that they do not feel that they are purposely making these vocalizations, but that something or someone is making those vocalizations for them, that they are allowing this to happen. In fact, I remember my very first discussion with them about how this happened. I made a comment about how you will do the speaking in tongues, and they kind of corrected me and said, well, we don't do the speaking in tongues. We allow ourselves to be open to that experience. And I think that that's very telling in terms of how they actually perceive the experience itself.
Wow. I kind of think of the analogy of flying an airplane, that I, supposing I had been an experienced pilot and I'm used to flying my plane, and then all of a sudden another pilot steps in and says, I'm going to take over the controls now for a while, and I would think that at least the first time it would be a rather startling experience.
Absolutely, and although, you know, it's an interesting analogy to think about various types of practices, various types of tasks that we as human beings do, and whether or not they ultimately become something that is somewhat automatic, so to speak. One of the more well-known ones would be, for example, a musician, where ultimately when you're talking about some of these highly experienced, like a jazz musician, and they just start just improvising, they're just going, and to some degree the notes are just coming to them as opposed to them purposely trying to make the notes occur. And similarly, you know, when you're learning how to play an instrument, you have to very consciously put your fingers in the right places or hit the right keys or whatever, but as you become a true expert at it, you don't think about that anymore, and those things just come very naturally to you.
Interesting analogy. Thank you for explaining that. It's for one who does not have that gift of speaking in tongues, this is a very interesting to understand what it must feel like. So out of curiosity, Dr. Newberg, have you ever scanned someone's brain who practices both centering prayer and speaking in tongues simultaneously?
No, we haven't. It's an interesting idea and something that I've certainly thought about, which is that when we look at this overall body of research, obviously we've just really scratched the surface. There's so much more for us to explore and do, and that includes evaluating people across different traditions, within different traditions, doing different kinds of practices within those traditions, looking at the same person doing different kinds of practices. The closest that we've come with regard to that, we did one study, which was an MRI study, where we had some individuals who were Sikhs, who did two different kinds of meditations, although they were somewhat similar, but we did see distinctions in their brain activity between the two types of practices. So one would certainly expect that if you had someone who knew how to do both centering prayer and also did speaking in tongues, that we would expect to see very different changes in their brain in those two different practices.
Mm-hmm. Well, that will be very interesting, and we look forward to hearing your future research on that, perhaps.
I'd love to do it, yes.
So, of course, glossolalia is many times looked at with disbelief, or, you know, there's many, many skeptics that just think that speaking in tongues is nothing more than gibberish, or perhaps just a series of random sounds with no meaning whatsoever, and just maybe a scam or something to impress other people, something on that order.
Right.
But in your book, Why We Believe What We Believe, you write, and I quote, "The language that emerged during glossolalic state was highly structured, filled with clearly articulated phrases." Even though you notice that structure, it was still, these utterances were incomprehensible to our ears. Is that correct?
Yes. And I wasn't specifically involved in that analysis. My colleagues were, but it certainly does have a fair degree of structure to it. But you know, you also raise another larger question, which is interesting in the context of this whole kind of neurotheology, using science to try to help us understand a little bit more about spirituality and religion. As you said, I mean, one of the things that's kind of interesting about glossolalia is that even within the religious communities, there's a fair amount of controversy over what it is and what it means. And some people, for those people who do it, they think it's one of the highest forms of prayer and spiritual experience in which they really deeply connect with and connect with God, whereas there are a lot of people who feel that this is, like you said, either false or maybe even worse, that it's evil, it's the work of the devil. And then, of course, from a scientific perspective, I'm sure a lot of non-believing scientists would argue that this is just various types of brain processes that are going on. So there's a lot of very interesting questions that come up, and to some degree, all our scans can show is what's going on in the brain when they do the practice, and whether or not what we see on the scans is consistent with how the experience is described. But the scans themselves or the experience itself doesn't necessarily prove whether or not it's true, good, bad, you know, whether the person is truly communing with God in some form or another. That is kind of a larger question that, at least from my own personal perspective, I do think we need to kind of use all of our resources to try to get to that kind of an answer. And I think that science is going to provide some information along those lines, but so do the experiences, so do the religious and spiritual doctrines and traditions. I think it's ultimately necessary for us to use a combination of all of our faculties and all of our abilities to be able, if we're going to get to an answer to those questions. I don't know if we ever will, but I think the most likely way that we will is to use some combination of all of the abilities that we as human beings have.
Right. So it sounds like, I mean, your research is more the objective facts. This is just what happens, and then we have to determine the subjective analysis of that, of what it means and where it's coming from and so
and
forth.
And its meaning, yes. Mm-hmm.
So the fact that it appears to be structured and have articulated phrases, in your book you state this is an unusual finding, for it suggests that the language was being generated from a different way or possibly from someplace other than the normal processing centers of speech.
Mm-hmm.
In the Bible, in 1 Corinthians 14:2, the Apostle Paul states, "For anyone who speaks in a tongue does not speak to people, but to God. Indeed, no one understands them. They utter mysteries of the Spirit." So, again, going back to the subjective analysis, do you think your research supports the statement that when a person is speaking in tongues, he or she is uttering mysteries of the Spirit?
Seems to suggest that it is not at least the usual processes of our intellect. It is not our usual language centers that are working. It is not our usual abstract, rational thought processes that are working. So it is a fundamentally different kind of thing that the person is doing. Again, whether or not that ultimately is, as you said, you know, them communing with God, or whether it is some other area of the brain that's taking over and doing stuff, that I couldn't tell you. But it does, there is a part of it that I think is accurate, that it is certainly not the normal ways in which human beings think and feel and interact with our world.
I see. So then, going back to perhaps the physical aspects in the context of health and well-being, what benefits do you see in individuals who practice centering prayer?
Well, I think with a lot of these practices, and centering prayer in particular, I guess I should say that the short answer is that I don't know if there has been any actual clinical studies that have shown the benefits of centering prayer. But if we extrapolate from what we know of other studies and what we see with centering prayer, what I think we can say is that when you engage these kinds of practices, practices that have a lot of meaning, practices that engage your brain, that help you to have a very powerful kind of meaningful experience, then what we tend to see is that the person will have overall an activation of areas of the brain that help to contribute to a controlling of our emotions, a greater sense of compassion and understanding of other people and also of the person themselves. They tend to reduce our levels of anxiety and depression in people when we engage in these kinds of practices. And if a person does all of that, then as the stress hormones in the body settle down, our immune system begins to work better. We have lower levels of inflammation in the body. So one might expect, ultimately, that not only is there an actual improvement in overall mental health, but it may confer some benefits to physical health as well. Now, again, there's a lot of extrapolation there from studies looking at meditation practices and other prayer practices.